Okay, well, it's a great pleasure and a great honour to be here to talk to you. As Jane said, I'm an alumnus myself, and I've given lectures in this space 20 years ago, I suppose. One of my problems in preparing for this is that I've been reading and thinking and writing about Moore for more than 20 years, so I can talk about Moore for 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours without a problem. In other words, I am not sure that I've made the right selection of stuff for this slot. I'll try and talk for about 50 minutes. Okay, so we're here, as Jane said, partly because Moore died 50 years ago. Just to put him in his context now, those of you who listened to the BBC Radio Proms this year may have noticed that they were partly focused on the 50th anniversary of the death of a very distinguished English composer, Ralph Vaughan Williams. And I mention that just to show that here we have a contemporary of Moore's, Vaughan Williams and Moore, and they were not simply contemporaries, they were actually friends. Vaughan Williams was an undergraduate at Trinity College at exactly the same time that Moore was an undergraduate, and there was quite a lot of correspondence between them. They went on walking parties together in the Lake District, and they played the piano together. Moore was a good pianist, and they used to sit down together, either with two pianos or perhaps sometimes, I don't know, playing with four hands on one piano. So there we see how Moore connects with a certain cultural context. And so there are Vaughan Williams' dates. You see there, he is almost exactly a contemporary of Moore's. He was born a year earlier. But, of course, Moore is more closely associated with two other philosophers, also from Trinity College, Bertrand Russell and Ludwig Wittgenstein. And so I put up here, actually, the dates of their respective births and deaths, and they are, in a way, slightly sad in one way. You can see that Russell was slightly older than Moore. Wittgenstein is a lot younger, 16 years younger than Moore. But then the ages of death are exactly reversed. Wittgenstein died first. Moore died, so to speak, in the middle, and Russell, who almost lived to be 100 years old, died last. Okay, let me say a little about Moore's family background and his early life. So he's born in South London. His parents were Baptists, and he had a fairly sort of evangelical Baptist upbringing. He describes Sundays as a day of Bible study and going to church to at least twice. His elder brother was called Thomas Sturge Moore, who was a poet, made his career as a poet, but also became, through the poetry, a close friend of Yeats. And if you get hold of early editions of Yeats's poetry, they have very attractive woodcuts by Sturge Moore. As I say, Moore was brought up as a Baptist. In his early years, he had a period of religious enthusiasm, somewhere around the ages of 12 to 14, and he blames his brother for dispelling that particular enthusiasm. But once it had been dispelled, he never, in a sense, went back to think much about religion. For him, it was just something that he had set aside. But in this respect, he differs both from Russell and from Wittgenstein. Russell, I think, never had any religious beliefs of any significance, and Russell became a fairly militant atheist throughout much of his career. Wittgenstein, by contrast, had very strong religious inclinations for much of his life, particularly after the First World War in the 1920s. And tried, in a sense, quite hard to become a serious Roman Catholic. Moore differs from both of those. He was simply not interested in religion. One of the peculiarities of Moore was that although he was baptized George Edward, he hated those names. So he's never called George Moore. And if you ever find people writing about him, calling him George Moore, you can be quite sure they basically know nothing about him. He's always just Moore. The only exception to that was that his wife called him Bill. But I think that that was very much a family name. It never permeated into his friends and associates. He went to school at Dulwich in South London, and he describes himself as being committed to the study of Latin and Greek and nothing else for many years. Okay, then he gets a classic scholarship to Trinity College, Cambridge in 1892, and he gets a first in Part 1 classics, and then, for reasons which I'll explain in a minute, for Part 2, he doesn't switch to the moral sciences, he adds moral sciences to his classics. So he does both together for the last 2 years at Cambridge. He gets a first in moral sciences and a lower second in Part 2 classics. Okay, now what is behind this? It's the friends that he makes. And one of the first friends he makes is Bertrand Russell. And here is Russell, who's a bit older and got to Cambridge a bit younger because he was a mathematician, and mathematicians always sort of get in early, don't they? So here's Russell describing his first meeting with Russell, with Moore. Beautiful and slim, with a look almost of inspiration, and so on. Well, this is the famous photograph of Moore that perhaps captures the young man that Russell thought was so exciting and beautiful and passionate, reminded him of Spinoza. It'd be nice to have some more, but that's the only one from about that period of whose existence I know at the moment. Another new friend of Moore's, also in Trinity, young philosopher, MacTaggart was a bit older. I'll say a bit more about MacTaggart in a minute, a bit older than Russell, was this philosopher, John Ellis MacTaggart MacTaggart, eccentric person, eccentric name. Now, in his autobiographical essay, Moore describes meeting MacTaggart, and he describes it in the way it's on the screen, talking about time as unreal, and Moore adds, "This must have seemed to me then, as it still does, a perfectly monstrous proposition, and I did my best to argue against it." But the facts are against Moore here, against his memory, because as soon as you look at Moore's writings from this period, from about 1894 to about 1900, he's completely besotted by MacTaggart's philosophy. So his first published paper is a defense of MacTaggart's views about the unreality of time. And his essays are all written in a very MacTaggart-style prose. Now, both Russell and MacTaggart were members of what's called, formally, the Cambridge Conversazione Society. Informally, it's always known as the Apostles. And part of their meetings with Moore was to sort of see whether he was thought to be a good egg, whether he would be the right kind of person to join this very extraordinary elitist discussion group that flourished in Cambridge at the time. And they decided that he was, so he becomes an apostle in 1894. So he's been at Cambridge 2 years by then. And for the next 10 years, Moore's membership of the apostles is a very important feature of his life. It's the context within which he makes friends and discusses philosophy and is stimulated to revise his views. And he preserved most of the papers that he wrote for the meetings of the apostles, quite a lot of them. And you can see in these papers him working through many of the ideas that then come to be published in his book Principia Ethica, about which I'll say some more. Okay, Moore had two teachers when he's an undergraduate at Trinity College, Cambridge. One was Henry Sidgwick. Sidgwick was then a professor of philosophy. None of that nonsense then that professors didn't teach undergraduates. No. Moore was taught by Sidgwick and by James Ward, who was the other professor of philosophy also at Trinity. So his two main teachers were the two professors. He didn't get on with Sidgwick. I guess Sidgwick was just bored of teaching undergraduates. He was nearly 60. but one thing that's preserved are one or two of Moore's undergraduate essays that he wrote for Sidgwick. And here you see the sort of MacTaggart-style prose. I won't read it through. It's sort of extraordinary stuff about unity in difference and so on. And Sidgwick has just written in the margin, metaphysics into which I cannot enter. And it's just striking because, in a sense, in 5 years' time, Moore is going to exactly echo Sidgwick's attitude. But it's not an attitude, despite what Moore wrote in that autobiography, that was appropriate to his undergraduate work. Here he is. Moore's other teacher, main teacher, was James Ward, who is an interesting philosopher, and I could talk quite a bit about him, but I won't. The important thing about James Ward is that Ward was one of the first British philosophers who had read and appreciated the importance of the work of the Austrian philosopher-psychologist Franz Brentano, who introduced the notion of intentionality that we now pay so much, perhaps too much, attention to. Well, Brentano introduced that into his psychology, and it was Ward who was one of the first people who brought Brentano's work to an English public, often not so to speak, acknowledging Brentano. And Ward taught Moore, and we'll see, it seems to me, the line of inheritance there. Okay, so Moore graduates in 1896. He then thinks he'd like to have a go at an academic career. Now, nowadays, once you've graduated and you have that thought, you then try to, you enter postgraduate courses. But there were no postgraduate courses, certainly in moral sciences in Cambridge at that time, and I don't believe that there were postgraduate courses in any subject. I don't think the PhD came to Cambridge until the 20th century. Now, I don't know the details about that, but basically the PhD is an import of the French and German doctorate, and I don't think that was imported into British universities until the 20th century. So what you did at that time was you put yourself into these fellowship competitions that colleges ran. And, of course, Moore was lucky. He'd been an undergraduate at Trinity. Trinity handed out then, as it still does now, probably more of these junior research fellowships, prize fellowships, as they were called, than in other colleges. OK, so he tries in 1897. That's just 1 year after graduating. Basically, he goes home and writes his dissertation, and he's unsuccessful. But he tries again in 1898, and second time around he succeeds. And just to show you the sort of context in which he's successful, and show also how Trinity was very, in a sense, fortunate in the last decade of the 19th century, MacTaggart, 1891, gets a fellowship for his book, The Studies in Hegelian Dialectic. Russell does it a few years later for the Foundations of Geometry, and then here is Moore. So they had three, so to speak, big names in one decade. Okay, so now I'm going to say a little bit about these dissertations. The dissertations disappeared for a bit, but then they resurfaced about 25 years ago, and they're now not in complete form, in a slightly, so to speak, piecemeal form, in the Wren Library. Okay, the 1897 dissertation, the first one, has the title The Metaphysical Basis of Ethics, and Moore is still in his full MacTaggartian mode, begins by acknowledging the importance of Bradley's work. This is F.H. Bradley, the leader of the British Hegelian absolute idealist movement. Basically, it's an idealist ethical theory that's being presented. But in the middle of it, suddenly, there is a subversive voice. There's an extended critical discussion of Kant's moral philosophy and a fairly sharp line of criticism that to the effect that Kant is just turning psychology into ethics. Now, we won't go into details, but that's, so to speak, the more that we know is suddenly beginning to come to the surface. Okay, 1 year later, it's the same topic, the metaphysical basis of ethics, but now you can see he's backing off from Bradley. It's no longer enthusiasm. It's, well, you know, it's very important stuff, but I no longer believe it all. And the main substance of what is now occurs in the dissertation is first a generalization of the criticism of Kant, and it's a generalization from the thought that Kant's ethics is too psychological to the thought that the whole of Kant's philosophy is just psychology dressed up as philosophy. And so he comes to think that the whole, what Kant called Copernican revolution, which puts somehow the subject of consciousness at the center of the world, that this was just a complete disaster. And alongside that, Moore begins to develop his own Brentano-inspired, or Ward-inspired, Brentano-esque conception of thought. And the way he expresses it is in terms of this conception of what he calls a proposition, and the thought is that the proposition, he says, is something independent of consciousness. So different people can think about the same thing, and the thing they're thinking about, the proposition, is neither a product of my mind nor the product of the other person's mind. It's independent of both of us. Okay, so Moore gets a prize fellowship on the basis of that dissertation. There's a very interesting examiner's report on that dissertation written by Bradley's very close associate, Bernard Bosanquet. And Bosanquet says, really, this is a fantastically intelligent piece of work, but it's completely wrong. And then, you know, Bosanquet can see exactly what's going on, that Moore is just going straight for the heart of the position that he and Bradley had worked out together. Well, maybe that's the kind of report that gets you a fellowship. So Moore's then, for 6 years at Trinity College, as a prize fellow. And, as I say, this is the most productive period of his life. Slightly, you might say, a bit sad, but, you know, it's a judgment you make in retrospect. And there are two major achievements. The first is the propagation, you might say, or development of this line of thought that's critical of the dominant philosophy of the period, British idealism. And secondly, the development of his views on ethics, the metaphysical basis of ethics, into the book for which he's most famous, Principia Ethica. Now, I'll say just a little about both. Okay, it's probably got too much text on here. Well, so what happens as Moore tries to refute or develop what he calls his refutation of idealism, and that's the title of one of his most famous papers, is that he takes it that idealists have conceived of the properties of experience, in particular those properties which philosophers traditionally called sensible qualities, like colour, taste, texture, temperature, things like that. They'd conceived of those qualities, sensible qualities, as essentially subjective. And then experience was a way of somehow projecting these subjective qualities out into the world. That's Moore's conception of what idealism involved. And as against that view, Moore puts forward a conception of consciousness, as he calls it, as, in his words, transparent or diaphanous. In other words, experience is not the projection of subjective qualities out onto the world, out onto a canvas. Instead, it's just, in a sense, you open your eyes just as you draw back the curtains covering a window, and what you see is what's there. And that's all there is. So the experience of blue is the experience of a colour whose existence is independent of your experience of it. Position known to philosophers as naive realism. But still, quite widely held, indeed increasingly widely held in recent years. So that's one theme of the refutation of idealism. And then there's a subordinate theme that comes in other papers. So we've got the thought from already that the objects of thought, these propositions, whatever they are independent of our thoughts about them. Now we have the thesis that colours and other apparent qualities of objects are independent of our experience of them. So these are things, propositions, colours and the like, whose existence is independent of our thought and experience. There's a when we think about them, when we experience them, we come into a relationship with them, but their existence is independent of us. Now, that thought, that there are, as it said, external relations, and that in particular our relationship with the world is an external relationship, that thought is the one that really goes to the heart of the idealist way of thinking. It's exactly what they denied. For them, this relationship is not external but internal, in the sense that there's a relation of dependence between propositions or colours and the rest and our thoughts about them. So what follows from Moore's line of thought is that the whole sort of rhetoric of absolute idealism, as it was called, to the effect that in order to understand any one thing, you had to understand everything, because everything was internally related to everything else, that thought can't really be sustained. Because if it's not true that all relations are internal, and in particular, if the relationship between the knowing subject and the objects of thought and experience is just an external relation, then, and the objects of thought, the objects of experience, are things that don't depend on our understanding of them at all, we can investigate them by themselves, in their own right. And we don't have to think that we need to know everything about our own investigation of them in order to understand them. So, absolute idealism is then pushed to one side. Okay. Now, I've just been, in a sense, echoing Moore's, you can call it argument, you can call it rhetoric. Moore's critics called it rhetoric and said, come on, Moore, let's have a look under the title and see what you're saying to undermine the arguments that go the other way. And you don't find very much, I'm afraid. But here's Russell looking back a bit later on the impact on him of these early papers of Moore's. So here's Russell saying, it's towards the end of 1898 that Moore and I rebelled against both Kant and Hegel, the great German idealists. Moore led the way, but I followed closely in his footsteps. So Russell's a bit older, and he's more established. He gets his prize fellowship at 1895, but Russell is a fully signed-up idealist in those early years. And then, but Russell then, as I say, he comes under Moore's influence for a bit. And he goes on, and this Russell puts this rather well. He says, I felt this new realist philosophy, he says, I felt it as a great liberation, as if I had escaped from a hothouse, the hothouse of idealism in which somehow everything was supposed to fit together and you couldn't understand one thing unless you understood everything, onto a windswept headland. So there's sort of, now it's open spaces, and there are these independent forces, and you can just be buffeted around by things. And I think that exactly captures the impact on Russell and of others of Moore's revolt against idealism. Okay, now I turn to Moore's most famous book from this period, Principia Ethica. The title, I'm afraid, is pretentious. It adverts to Newton, to Newton's Principia. So Moore sees, is putting himself up, I'm afraid, as the Newton of ethics. God. Well, that's the kind of hyperbolic view that people have of themselves when they're, 27, 28. Okay, and the claim he makes about his book, in the book, is that for the first time he's showing how we can get systematic knowledge of fundamental ethical truths. That's his phrase. And what Moore says is these fundamental truths are truths about what's good. Most other people took it that the fundamental ethical property or concept was the concept of what's right or what ought to be done. But Moore takes it that that's a mistake. Now, we won't go into that, but it's an important point. Now, Moore makes three claims about goodness. He says, first, he says it's indefinable. And what he means by that is that you can't define goodness and, by implication, rightness in terms which are independent of ethics. So you can't derive ethical conclusions from some broader psychological or sociological or theological theory that hasn't got any ethical premises built into it from the start. The second thing Moore holds is that goodness, he says, is not a natural or metaphysical property. Now, Moore tends to think that this point follows from the previous one, but actually that's a mistake by him, because the position that Moore hasn't clearly identified, but which he's assuming must be mistaken, is the position which says there's some notion of human nature, let's say, which is fundamental and psychological and moral right from the start. And if you take that view, then you'll take it that the notion of a human good, what's good for us, is one that is both indefinable, because it's in a sense it's fundamental, can't be defined in non-ethical terms, but it's also psychological. Now, that position, I'm afraid, has not somehow crossed Moore's horizon. And it's a great weakness of the book that it hasn't, but we need to understand that that's where Moore is committing himself. Now, the third point that Moore makes is one that, in Principia Ethica, he doesn't make a great deal of, but it comes up more in later writings, which is a very interesting thought that's been much developed later. He says, goodness, he says, is not a substantial property. Instead, it's a dependent or derivative property. So, whether something is of value, it must depend on its other properties. And that, on the face of it, is, as soon as you think about it, is right. But the conclusion that we get to with Moore is that goodness or value is an irreducible, indefinable feature of various states of things, which is not itself substantial, but is dependent upon their properties, and is not dependent in a way which involves a relationship to natural or metaphysical entities like human nature or God. And it seems to me it's the current American philosopher Tim Scanlon, who gives the best account of this, that for something to be good, then, is simply for it to have properties, other properties, which provide us with reasons for promoting things of that kind. So my claim, and this is perhaps directed particularly at those of you who know current writing in this area, is that where Scanlon contrasts his position with Moore, it's because he hasn't read Moore carefully, he hasn't spotted that this third point is in Principia Ethica right from the start. Okay, well, what kinds of things are good? Well, Moore says there are lots of many different kinds of things, but there are two that have preeminent value, which he picks out as states of consciousness, which may be roughly described as the pleasures of human intercourse, slightly portentous phrase, and the enjoyment of beautiful objects. Now, there are two or three things just to pick out about that. First, these are states of consciousness, and it's very characteristic of Moore's ethical position to hold that the most valuable things are states of consciousness. It's not relationships between people, nothing social or political, it's a certain state of consciousness. Slightly worrying thought that that's the most valuable thing. The second thing to note is that although Moore criticizes hedonism, the view that what's good is pleasure, it turns out that his most preeminent goods are pleasures and enjoyments. So, Actually, it's a kind of elitist hedonism that we've got here, I'm afraid. And it turns out that the value of your enjoyment of beautiful objects is greatly enhanced when you know a good deal about those objects. Okay, so, you know, it's one thing for me, in my ignorant state of mind, to admire, say, some of Rothko's paintings, but it's much more valuable if someone who really knew and appreciates properly the subtlety of Rothko's paintings. Okay, well, it's not clear what's going on here and why Moore has got to that, why he's putting this position forward. So if we ask him, well, why? Why should I think this? He has no answer. And this is the really fatal flaw in Moore's moral theory. Moore says we just have to take these things as what he calls self-evident, propositions whose truth is supposed to, in a sense, speak for themselves. So we cannot give any reasons or evidence for them. Why not? Because goodness is indefinable, so they can't be derived. Secondly, goodness is neither natural nor metaphysical, so they can't be substantiated by psychological, theological, or sociological theories. All of that would, Moore thinks, make the mistake of treating goodness as natural. So what do we do? Particularly, what do we do when we face disagreements? Well, Keynes described it brilliantly in this passage in My Early Beliefs. I'll just read it. He said, in practice, victory was with those who could speak with the greatest appearance of clear, undoubting conviction and could best use the accents of infallibility. Moore, at this time, was a master of this method, greeting one's remarks with a gasp of incredulity. Do you really think that? An expression on his face, as if to hear such a thing, said, reduced him to a state of wonder verging on imbecility. Oh, he would say, goggling at you as if either you or he must be mad. No reply possible. But there is one famous occasion where, in a way, Moore, you might say, met his match. The story is described by Russell. Russell brought D.H. Lawrence to dine in Trinity. This is, in, I think, in 1913. And set Lawrence and Moore beside each other at dinner. Now, their self-evident beliefs were miles apart. And there was nothing that they could do to make any, in a sense, sensible conversation, the two of them. Moore might try this method, but I'm sure Lawrence was just as good at giving back what he got. And eventually, conversation between them ceased, and they were just silent. Okay, well, I've indicated, I think this is just hopeless as far as ethical theory goes. And in particular, Moore said, and the whole point of the title of the book is that this is ethical knowledge. But actually, as soon as you work through, you see that so far from providing ethical knowledge, it's undermining its possibility. And I think there's a straight line from that line of thought to the ethical non-cognitivism, which has been such a prominent feature of 20th century ethical theory, in my view, an unfortunate feature. However, I don't, in these comments, want to say that Principia Ethica isn't an enormously important work. And its importance lies not, I think, so much in the position that it puts forward, but in the way in which it's put forward. It's put forward in a self-consciously explicit way so that you can more or less see what the steps in the reasoning are supposed to be. And if you don't like the conclusions, you can see which bits of the argument that got you there you'll have to call into question. And that's, in a way, the achievement of Principia Ethica, that it introduced analytical rigor back into ethical theory. If you turn from Moore to the writings, at any rate, of the idealist philosophers of the time, you are in the fog. You don't know what's supposed to be premise and what's supposed to be conclusion, because, of course, everything supports everything else. Everything is internally related. And you just, I just sort of give up. Now, admittedly, the Sidgwick was quite different again, and Sidgwick's Method of Ethics is also a great work. I could talk more about the relationship between Sidgwick and Moore on this, but I think not now. Okay, let's say a little about Moore and Bloomsbury. So Moore's at Trinity as a prize fellow. He's a member of the Apostles, and he, as Russell had done with him, he then goes out looking for the beautiful young men who are lively and intelligent and who it would be fun to talk to, and recruits them into the Apostles. And so he builds up this group of close friends: Desmond McCarthy, Clive Bell, Leonard Woolf, Lytton Strachey, Maynard Keynes, and Toby Stephen were the, in a sense, the core group. They weren't actually all apostles, I should add. Now, that group leaves Cambridge, more or less all as a group, in 1904. And it so happens that in 1904, the Stephen family, the children of Leslie Stephen, who've been living in Kensington Gate with this sort of Victorian old father, he dies, and they can't wait to get away from that context, and so they move to Bloomsbury, to Gordon Square. And the key link between the two groups is Toby Stephen, who alas dies young. But Toby invites his Cambridge friends to come to come and meet his beautiful sisters, Vanessa and Virginia. And that's the beginning of the Bloomsbury group. Now, Moore is not a member of that group, but he is there, so to speak, in spirit. Here is Virginia Stephen, Virginia Woolf, describing one of their early meetings. I won't read it all through, just towards the end. So Virginia is describing the kind of silences that they had. And then Virginia says, then at last Vanessa, having said perhaps she'd been to some picture show, incautiously used the word beauty. And at that point, one of the young men would lift his head slowly and say, it depends what you mean by beauty. And all at once our ears were pricked. It was as if the bull had at last been turned into the ring. And the bull might be beauty, it might be good, it might be reality. Whatever it was some abstract question that now drew out all our forces. Okay. So what they were doing was they were, in a sense, picking up the kind of conversation that they'd been familiar with in Cambridge, with Moore, talking about beauty, good, and reality, and taking that down to Bloomsbury. So Moore was there in spirit, though not, as I say, in person. Moore himself, the trajectory of Moore's life, then takes a slightly different course. 1904, his fellowship comes to an end, and he's not renewed, so he leaves Cambridge. He goes initially to Edinburgh and then back to London. The whole style of his writing changes enormously. And I think that I've never seen a kind of, I should put it, a self-examination by him in this period, but I myself, I'm fairly confident that there was a kind of loss of self-confidence. And the style of his writing in particular, it becomes obsessive in a way. He needs to make himself really clear before he makes even the smallest move. It's as if, I think, he looked back at some of his early papers, The Refutation of Idealism and Principia Ethica, and he thought, my God, this is awful stuff. Never write anything like that ever again in your life. So here's now a nice letter that Leonard Woolf wrote, it's a bit later in 1911, describing how Moore and actually Lytton Strachey are sitting in the garden, some house in the summer. They're both writing. Lytton Strachey is composing his Landmarks of French Literature, and he complains that he's mentally constipated because nothing at all comes to his mind. Mm-hmm. Moore, on the contrary, said that his mental constipation came from the fact that as soon as he'd written down a sentence, he saw that it was just false or that it required a sentence to qualify the qualification. that absolutely captures Moore's writing, qualifying qualifications. Okay, so, but by this time, 1911, Moore, in fact, is back in Cambridge. He's appointed to a lectureship, princely sum then of £50 per annum to be a university lecturer in moral sciences. So he comes back to live in Cambridge. In 1916, he marries Dorothy Ely, who had been a student of moral sciences at Newnham, and they buy this house, which is number 86 Chesterton Road. It's at the sort of Cambridge end of Chesterton Road on the side by the river. It used to be, when I went there, quite an attractive old Victorian house. I'm afraid it's now turned into some kind of student lodging, and as part of the quote-unquote renovation, it's been sort of spray-painted with some ghastly grey stuff, which blots out all the character that it used to have. The Moores had two sons, Nicholas and Timothy. It was Timothy whom I knew, because Timothy, after he retired, lived there. I'll say just a little about Nicholas at the end. 1925, Moore is appointed to the professorship at Cambridge, professor of, as it said, of mental philosophy and logic. I think they're now just called professor of philosophy. And that's the chair that he occupies for the next, whatever it is, 15, 14 years, until he retires in 1939. Okay, here's a picture of Moore from, it's actually from 1936. Sorry, I don't know if you can see it. It's a bit gloomy, really. The sun's come out. He's holding a paper that he's delivering, I think, at the Moral Sciences Club, which is the sort of in-house group for the philosophers at Cambridge. Okay, so Moore, he gets this established position. Now, one of the things that's then disappointing is that he never writes another monograph. So he writes Principia Ethica in 1903. He writes this little short book on ethics, but just before he gets to Cambridge, it's called Ethics. He never writes another monograph. He writes chunky papers, but increasingly few of these after the 1920s or 1922 or 3. Well, why does he write so little, publish so little at any rate? Well, I think there are two reasons. One is that he's obsessive about writing his lectures. He writes them out in manuscript, and he always writes a fresh set of lecture notes each year. And the lecture load then in Cambridge was rather more demanding than it is now. And he kept all his lecture notes, and I at one time was entrusted with them, and I can tell you that there were boxes and boxes of them, so they're all now in the university library. And, you know, you can see that it would take you a lot of time each year to write the sort of dense pile of paper that has now accumulated. The other thing that happens, as which Jane mentioned, when where I would sympathise with Moore, is that he was editing Mind, this distinguished British philosophy journal. And, well, I have a team of people and an editorial office. I think Moore just did it, you know, alongside everything else on his desk. So no doubt that took up a lot of his life as well. However, there is a theme to this later work, conception of philosophy as what was called at the time the analysis of common sense. Now, I'll just say a little bit about this. Now, Moore's commitment to philosophical analysis goes right back to his earliest work. It goes back to the rejection of idealism. But what's distinctive about Moore, at any rate, from about 1910 onwards, is that he appreciates the importance of Russell's breakthroughs in logic, and in particular Russell's conception of logical analysis. And Moore plays a historically important role in what you might call legitimating this logical analysis as a method of philosophy, and I think also, in a sense, domesticating it, making it available to philosophers who were not mathematical logicians. And one of the ways in which Moore did this was that as he, in a sense, made use of Russell's theory, Russell's logical theory, Moore was very insistent that it had to be, in a sense, applied to ordinary language as we use it. And Moore came, in the light of this, to see that there was often a bit of a gap between the moves that Russell's logical theory seemed to legitimate and the structure of inference expressed in ordinary language. And he often then inferred that actually Russell got the logic wrong, and that, you know, if you started from ordinary language, you could get a better sense of the logical structure of thought than if you started from Russell's theory. It's a move that's increasingly present in Moore's thought from the 1930s onwards, and it's one that then continues for the rest of 20th century. And I think it's one of the most productive things that you find in Moore's writings. Now, so there is this phrase that we all sort of worry about a bit these days, analytic philosophy. Was Moore an analytic philosopher? Yes, certainly he was. And he was one of the first people, I think, of whom you could say definitively, that's the kind of philosopher that he was. And it's not surprising, then, that the phrase analytic philosophy first crops up, not, I think, in Moore's mouth or in his writings, not so far as I know. It's first used by John Wisdom in some writings from the late 1920s. But he's describing the kind of philosophy that Moore does. Now, does Moore think that philosophy is just analysis? This was actually a question that Wisdom put to Moore at one point, and Moore said emphatically no. Analysis is a method of philosophical inquiry, but the method has to be distinguished from the conclusions that people try to draw from it. So in this sense, Moore is, if you like, for those of you who know your Wittgenstein, you know that Wittgenstein in the Tractatus wanted to say that philosophy is just a method and there are no theses that should be advanced by philosophers. Moore is not of that persuasion. He thinks there is a method, the method of analysis, but he also thinks the aim is to try to establish some distinctive metaphysical, epistemological, or ethical theses. Now, there are two things that are, I think, characteristic of Moore's application or use of his method of analysis. So one is that he works on lots of different fronts. As Jane was saying, I work on lots of different fronts. And in that way, I'm Moorean. Because Moore is not trying to construct a systematic general philosophy. So he's working in a piecemeal way on lots of different issues. And that's why, actually, it's not so much this journal Mind that he edited for so long that, I think, captures the spirit of Moorean philosophy. It's a different journal. It's called Analysis. Moore helped to found it. He wrote a little piece for the very first issue of Analysis called The Justification of Analysis. And Analysis, it has short pieces, preferably 2,000 to 3,000 words only, on a wide range of subjects. That's Moorean philosophy. And the other thing that's characteristic of Moore's writings, and this becomes increasingly true of his later writings, is that he's very impatient of philosophical terminology. And this, I think, is something that I think Wittgenstein took from him. So, you know, if he's confronted with someone talking about transcendental idealism, he'll say, well, come on, just tell me in terms of, you know, space and time, or in terms of, I don't know, looking at a physical object, what's going on here? Let's try not to use this jargon if we can possibly avoid it, if we can manage without it. Again, you have the sense there of the, in some sense, the preeminence, the authority of ordinary language, and philosophical jargon ought to be answerable to the inferences, the habits of thought that are already encapsulated in ordinary language. Okay, so Moore, as I said, the slogan that he gives himself is analyzing common sense. I've talked about analysis. Now, what about common sense? Common sense isn't quite ordinary language. It is, insofar as Moore is a systematic philosopher, this is the one bit that is, in a sense, quasi-systematic, but you'll see it's quite different from anything like Bradleyan idealism. Common sense is best characterized by what Moore calls a long list of truisms, such as, the Earth has existed for many years before I was born. I won't read through the list. They are utterly banal truths that Moore holds we all accept. And the second element of Moore's claim about common sense is not only are these truisms all true, we all know they're true, and we all know that everybody else knows they're true. So they're common knowledge, as it's said. And these points are connected because Moore takes the view, as others do, that when you assert something, when you assert the truth of something, you commit yourself to the thought that you know that it's true. So if Moore asserts a whole list of truisms, he thereby commits himself to thinking that he knows that they're true. So truth and knowledge are in this way inseparable, or claims to truth and claims to knowledge. However, although the points are in that way connected, Moore recognized that they are equally separable. You could deny the truth of these common sense beliefs, or you could deny that we actually know their truth. And the person, Moore says, who denies their truth is the idealist. The person who denies that we have knowledge is the skeptic. So this is going to be the last lap of this quick tour through Moore's thought. What about idealism? What's his response to the idealist in his later work? Well, it's actually remarkably concessive, because what Moore says, he doesn't try to argue for the truth of these truisms. What he says is, look, we all accept they're true. Question is, how should they be understood? How should we analyze them? And the analysis is supposed to be provide some systematic account of what's being said, which identifies what Moore calls the principle or the ultimate subject of what's being said. And it turns out that when Moore is dealing with sort of banal claims like here's a hand, he'll allow that there can be an analysis of what's being said which identifies its principle or object or ultimate subject as something to do with the sense experiences of the person who's talking. Whoops! I thought we were supposed to be realists here. But if the principle and ultimate subject of our talk about the physical world might turn out to be the sense experiences of the speaker, then suddenly we're back with idealism. And what happens in this later period is that Moore inserts into his sort of realist picture something that is at least permits all the idealist moves we thought we were supposed to have forgotten about. Because ordinary language is realist, fine. And the idealists themselves never denied that. But they said we have to distinguish between appearance, which is their term for ordinary language or common sense, and reality, which might be rather different. Moore's talk about the distinction between the truisms of ordinary language and the analysis which identifies the principle and ultimate subject is just the appearance-reality distinction in a different vocabulary. So Moore, in a sense, by emphasizing the role of the analysis of common sense, suddenly lets back into the whole story the idealism that in his earlier work he thought he'd banished, or others thought he'd banished. Okay, what about skepticism? Well, more notoriously claimed that we know all the kind of truistic material I was talking about, but what about skeptics who deny that we have good grounds for these claims to knowledge? Well, Moore tended at certain periods of his life, in a way, rather to dismiss these skeptics by saying, well, look, I'm more certain that I know that I'm standing up and talking than I am of the truth of your fancy speculations that I might now be dreaming, or that I might, there might be some evil genius that's taken over my consciousness. I'm much more certain of these things, that I know these things, than I could ever be of your skeptical hypotheses. Well, you can say those things, but in order to vindicate the claim to knowledge, you need to do, he came to see, a bit more. You need to somehow to be able to, as he says, eliminate them, show that they, these skeptical possibilities, like the possibility that I'm dreaming now, are just groundless. And famously, in two of his last papers, Moore tried to do this, and he failed. I was going to read you the sentences at the very end of his last paper where he acknowledges failure, but he does, he fails. So the anti-skeptical sort of dialectic or rhetoric, I'm afraid, ends unsuccessful. It's not a happy ending. But there is, in a sense, a footnote, an appendix to this, which in a way, I think, vindicates the importance of much of Moore's line of thought. What happens is Moore's friends, associates, see there's something right about what he's doing, but that he can't, he's not doing it right. He's not got the right mode of thought to get to the conclusions that he wants to get to. And the first person who has a go at improving, so to speak, on Moore's method is Norman Malcolm, who'd studied with him, and he wrote a famous paper called Defending Common Sense. It's published in 1949. Malcolm's paper doesn't quite diagnose what's going wrong in Moore, but what happens, and it's a very historically fortunate coincidence, Wittgenstein is staying with Norman Malcolm in the United States when the paper comes out, and Moore writes to Malcolm saying, I don't agree with you, and Moore is quite acute in explaining why Malcolm's criticisms of him are unwarranted. But that sets Wittgenstein off to start thinking about these issues for the first systematic time in his life. And for the next couple of years, the last 2 years of Wittgenstein's life, he writes extraordinary series of notes developing a sort of internal critique of Moore's approach to epistemology, which was published posthumously as his book On Certainty, which is the most wonderful of Wittgenstein's late writings, and which, it seems to me, as I say here, provides a kind of Hegelian Aufhebung, sort of transcendent or sort of incorporation but equally correction of what Moore had been trying to work out in the context of his skeptical, anti-skeptical defense of common sense. Okay, it's 4:15, so I'll just whiz through one or two very small final things. So he retires, Moore retires in 39, he spends the war years, World War II years in the States because his American friends think he's by then a bit of a frail old man. He needs to be protected from the severities of rationing and so on. He comes back to this country, comes back to 86 Chesterton Road, but in 1950 he has a mild heart attack or something similar, and after that he doesn't live a very energetic life. When Wittgenstein comes round to come and talk to him, Wittgenstein knows at this time that he's dying of cancer. Dorothy, Moore's wife, says, well, you can come and talk to him, but you can't get him all excited. And Wittgenstein gets rather cross because Wittgenstein thought, as he famously said, you should die with your boots on. But Dorothy is very insistent and ushers him out of Moore's study after about half an hour. Okay, in 1951, he gets he's quite rightly given the award of the Order of Merit, but he then lingers on. He dies in 1958, and he's buried, his ashes rather, are interred in what was then known as St. Giles' Cemetery, what's now called All Saints Cemetery. And those of you who don't know this cemetery, I would recommend a visit to it, particularly on a day like this. I won't explain now where it is, but if you want to catch me afterwards, I'll tell you where it is. Okay, I was going to talk through that. Last thing, very last thing, I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit, but there is this final bit here. Many people left, after Moore died, there was a sort of rush of obituaries from his friends. And one point they wanted to emphasize was the impact of his personality. that there was something about his character that opened up to people, which almost nobody else could do. He wasn't intimidating, but you had a sense with him of, and well, they all use this phrase, a great person or a great mind. Now, it's not a phrase I think we now use about each other. But here is Gilbert Ryle, who was a friend of Moore's for many years, quite a lot younger, and came to Cambridge to work with him when Ryle was much, much younger than Moore. And so this is in Ryle's obituary, and I think it is probably a very authentic character description of Moore. So I'll just read this and then we'll stop. "So for some of us, there still lives the Moore whose voice is never quite resuscitated by his printed words. He gave us courage not by making concessions, but by making no concessions to our youth or to our shyness. He would explode at our mistakes and muddles with just that genial ferocity with which he would explode at the mistakes and muddles of philosophical high-ups, and with just the genial ferocity with which he would explode at mistakes and muddles of his own. He would listen with minute attention to what we said, and then, without a trace of discourtesy or courtesy, treat our remarks simply on their merits, sometimes without a trace of politeness or patronage, crediting them with whatever positive utility he thought that they possessed." Okay, that's more. Okay, I'm stopping.